Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The founding principles enshrined in the Constitution are unlike that of any country in the history of this world or any country that exists today. And it is those founding principles, those constitutional protections that each of us as Americans enjoy, that will allow us to do what we have always done in the history of this country, which is to adapt, to survive, and to thrive.
At the Milliken Institute's Global Conference, Arizona Independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema.
And so with that constitution, unique in the world, that is what allows us to continue to have hope for the future, to achieve each of the American dreams that every person who sets forth a foot on this soil to enjoy, unlike any other country in the world.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think there's a couple of things, including who shows up at the primaries, right, even if they're given the chance to and they're given more options, who shows up to vote at all, and how they understand it.
Alan Schwartz with Guggenheim Partners moderating a state of politics session at the Milken Institute's Global Conference.
It feels like the primaries, the people who are the most ardent about a particular issue, they can turn out the primary. And second, are there rules we can create that make it easier for people to be able to vote? And there's all sorts of debates about that, but what do you think about that?
Oklahoma Senator James Lankford.
I think the biggest issue is getting people, as you were mentioning, out to show up and vote. When there are eight people that are running for a primary, many people will say, tell me when there's two, and then I'll go vote. I don't want to research eight people. I don't want to think about that. Or it becomes hard to be able to get accurate information. I think that's a key issue, is getting more people to vote in primaries, more information to people that is as clear as we can make it, either as parties or individuals or information that's out there, period, and then encouraging people to actually show up in primaries and vote. Because if we don't affect the primaries, we don't affect what actually happens in November. And we have lots of people that say, I'm frustrated with November. And I say, yes, there was several months ago, you had a lot more options at that point, and you've got to be able to be engaged. I do think our biggest challenge, though, as Kyrsten was saying, is cultural right now. When I talked before about that we have a one-vote majority in the House and a one-vote majority in the Senate, we literally are the most divided in the history of our nation as far as legislatively. It's not that, and I hear people say, we've never been more divided than this as a country, and I always smile and say, have you ever heard of 1861 in the Civil War? We have had more divided times than what we have right now. But where we are is we are very divided of what direction to go. I think the problems have grown so large. Debt, deficit, what's going to happen with inflation in our economy? How do we deal with the differences between wealth and poverty in our nation and try to bring people together? Immigration, there are so many very large, very complicated issues that we now have more people just retreating to cat videos on TikTok and saying, I'm just not going to pay attention anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to pay attention. Those are hard. The challenge is some of that has moved to Congress as well. We have members of Congress that will not do the work that it takes to develop a real solution. They'll do a bumper sticker answer into a press conference and walk away from an issue. That's a problem. It takes one to do a press conference. In the Senate, it takes 60 to make law. It is really easy to do that press conference and walk away. It's really hard to sit down with people you disagree with and say, this is hard. How are we going to deal with Social Security, what Bill works on all the time? How are we going to deal with Medicare? It's very complicated. How are we going to deal with debt and deficit issues? When are we going to admit there really is a problem on this? And we sit down with people we disagree with, like grown-ups do, and actually have that hard conversation, get to a decision, and work to the next issue. But I remind people all the time, D.C. is a mirror to the country.
Mm-hmm.
No one wants to admit that. Everyone thinks D.C. is an anomaly. D.C. is not an anomaly. We're a representative republic.
No, it's representative.
We're a mirror to the country. And when people say to me, that's not true, D.C.'s angry and yelling at each other all the time, I typically will say to them, what was Thanksgiving like at your house last year? When the whole family got together. And often people will laugh just like that and go, oh, yeah, we left early. You know, so because we find we are that divided as a country because the problems are large. And what we really need are leaders to be able to sit down and to say, these are hard. We're supposed to do hard things. Let's do hard things.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Coming into this year, we were expecting beef production to be down around 5% plus or minus on top of the 4.7% decrease last year.
Oklahoma State livestock marketing economist Dr. Darrell Peel on carcass weights.
Cattle slaughter is down for the year. We have less cattle, and we know we're going to continue with tighter numbers there. But in the short run, feedlots, because of the economics of replacing cattle in the feedlot, they've got an incentive, and particularly with the cost of gain going down recently as corn prices have come down, all of those things lead to an incentive for feedlots to hang on to cattle longer, feed them to heavier weights. And I say all that to say that carcass weights are running, they actually went up counter seasonally in March and April. And so we're running about 27 pounds heavier for both steers and heifers compared to a year ago. Now, seasonally, these carcass weights should be coming down to a low around the end of May or 1st of June, and then they typically go up back up in the last part of the year. And I do think we'll see some more seasonal decrease in them, but they're decreasing from a higher level. And so, I think we're going to continue to see these carcass weights running well above a year ago. That's obviously offsetting part of the declining slaughter numbers. So beef production is still down for the year and will be down for the year, but probably not as much as we earlier thought if these heavy weights persist like I expect them to. And we'll see what happens. By the end of the year, we could really be pushing these carcass weights to levels where, we may find out just how far we can push them. Because, again, packers, feedlots and packers both have an incentive to try to get more pounds out of fewer cattle in a market like this. And so we'll see what happens. There'll certainly be an incentive to keep these weights heavy for the, rest of the year for sure.
And incentives.
Both feedlots and packers are volume businesses. So it comes down to capacity and utilizing that capacity. So when cattle numbers get tight, then, that's harder for them to do. But the other thing they can do is try to maintain production in the sense of pounds of beef produced. Now, for feedlots, they can maintain feedlot capacity, and they've actually done a pretty good job of this over the last couple of years, keeping feedlot inventories high by slowing down the rate of throughput. So if you slow down the turnover in the feedlot, you're not producing more beef. You're actually producing less cattle over time, but you can keep them in the feedlot longer, slow down the turnover rate, and keep the feedlot full, which is the motivation, at least in the short run, for the feedlots, is to keep feeding, to keep the feedlot full from a feeding standpoint. So that leads to this incentive to, essentially hang on to cattle longer and push the weights higher, potentially to overfeeding these cattle. On the packer side, it's kind of the same thing. If there's not enough cattle to utilize the packing capacity as well as they would like and keep costs down, then one of the ways they can potentially offset is by just getting more pounds out of every carcass they are hanging up. And so they have an incentive to let those carcasses get big up to some physical limit in the plant where they just simply, can't manage them anymore. And, there can be some meat side implications as well. Again, we're getting a lot of trim off of these cattle right now with the amount of fat on them. The Y4 percentage is pretty high. And so that plays back into how that stuff gets utilized in the ground beef market. And so there's just a lot of pieces to this thing that all come down to how the industry is dealing with the fact that we're in very tight cattle numbers and going to get tighter at some point in time because, again, we're still feeding quite a few heifers. And if you look at the most recent slaughter data for female slaughter, cow plus heifer slaughter, is still running over 51% of total slaughter. So we have not really cut back on the female side that would indicate that we're trying to, get set for rebuilding, herd rebuilding. So that's going on at this point, and there's a lot more tightness ahead as we get into that at some point in time.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Two of the three people that were involved in the immigration, that border hole package, are sitting right here. Kirsten Sinema, myself, and Chris Murphy.
Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford on trying to get a border security and immigration solution passed.
We spent an inordinately large amount of time together, the three of us, over almost 5 months. Literally from the middle of October until February, we worked every single day on this except Thanksgiving Day, Christmas Day, and half of New Year's Day. Other than that, we literally worked on it every day. When we talk about trying to be able to move it, it's very technical, it's very challenging, but it's also extremely political. And as Bill was talking about before, any piece of this can have its own challenges. I would tell you one of the things that I really understand even more on that is the biblical term of everything there is a season. Once we got past December and we started moving into January and February of this year, and the political primary season started rising up, people started turning their attention away from policy and more towards politics, and we lost our season. That was number one. Number two is we need to have as many people on board as we possibly can to be able to work through this. As you're working through something extremely challenging and difficult, you've got to have people that are committed to actually getting it done. We had a lot of people that were committed to it being done, but not doing it. So there's a big interest in saying this needs to get behind us as a country, but actually getting engaged to be able to solve it. Now that's different, especially something as technical as this. And so for Kirsten and I, and with Chris Murphy working through all this, we were constantly looking for allies that wanted to not only see it was done, but to actually help us actually get it done. And that's still an ongoing challenge for us. So yesterday we had about 5,800 people illegally crossing the border yesterday. We probably will again today. The problem still remains. So this is not going away. The problem still remains. And when it wasn't able to pass the Senate, I contacted leadership of the House and said, you guys put together a bipartisan package that can pass the House and send it to the Senate. And 2 months later, they said, yeah, we couldn't get it done.
Speaking of border security, it's something West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin is familiar with.
In 2013, we passed a bill, a total immigration overhaul bill, had 68 votes in the Senate, so it passed. Unbelievable piece of legislation, tremendous amount of border security, but also a pathway to legal immigration. And as a country, if we ever stop or prohibit illegal immigration, God help our country, we won't be the country we are. And you got to be careful of that. So when James is talking about, and what he and Kirsten did was tremendous. They worked and had a bill that we thought was a slam dunk. They've come to an agreement, let's do it. And on Sunday night, we had it. Monday night, it got questionable. Tuesday night, we lost it. Wednesday, the vote went down because of Donald Trump jumping into it at that time, made a statement. But John Boehner, a dear friend of mine, we passed a bill in 2013, and it went over to the House. And I called John Boehner, and he's been a dear friend. I said, John, just put it on the floor. It'll pass. I know it'll pass. He says, Joe, I can't. Eric Cantor just got beat by a far-right Tea Party in Richmond, and they use it as amnesty, and says Eric Cantor was supporting amnesty, so it killed it. He was afraid. But he'll tell you today, one of the greatest opportunities he missed when you say everything has its time, is by not putting that on, because we'd have been out of this system by now. We wouldn't have had this as a major concern.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The success that we've had, or any failure, but the success we've had is because you have four people who like each other. We know each other, know our families, know our backgrounds, and we really care about each other. And if you have a friend, no matter whether they have a D or an R by your name, you don't want to put your friend in a difficult position. You want to work it out with him. It's hard to say no to a friend.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin at the Milken Institute's 2024 Global Conference.
Building relationships is extremely difficult. Every one of us knows that. And you have to put really, the country has to be before either our personal self or our politics. And once you're able to decipher who's there for that purpose, you're just like a magnet. You're drawn to them. You know who wants to be there and wants to do the right thing. So these are my friends, and I appreciate all the success that we've had, and I appreciate all the challenges. And still, I look at every challenge that basically we can still overcome them. The filibuster, I come from West Virginia, which is Bob Byrd territory. Bob Byrd pretty much wrote the rules of the Senate. And he told me, I've known him forever, and when I was governor, he said, now, Joe, he said, this Senate's the most unusual place. There's nothing like it in the world. There's nothing like us. We're so special. And he says, because basically, we can put the glue to it. We can put stability to something. So as hard as it might be to make something happen, to find agreement with 60 votes right now, he says, it's that even harder to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. So the stability we have, the rest of the world looks for leadership and looks for stability. That's what gives it to it. But Kirsten and I were both amazed that our colleagues in the Democrat side left us. They were all being driven by, and we were both concerned about, can we do more for voting rights, protect voting rights, this and that. But that's pretty much a state issue. And we knew the courts were the checks and balances there, so we figured it would be worked out. But to throw away the filibuster to where really it made us say, okay, now, James and Bill, what do you think? What can we do to make this happen? Okay, that wouldn't be necessary. Who's ever in power, if you've got 50, plus if the president and vice president, that's 51, you can do what you want. If you think it's been dysfunctional with the House right now, what's going on in the House, we get rid of the filibuster, it'll be on steroids in the Senate. Mm-hmm. It'll be so dysfunctional. It'll destroy. And what happens there, you have no ability to say, well, we've passed this piece of legislation, and I guarantee you, in 2 years, if the tide turns, it'll be repealed. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to prevent. So we've done a good job of that, I believe. And when you look at all the things we've done in a bipartisan way, you know, we, even if some of our Republican friends couldn't vote with us on, sometimes we would differ, I'm still wanting their input. I want to know what. Tell me why. Tell me if I could have made it better. Tell me if I could have given you a reason. And that's what that's the conversations you have to have. But today, and I've said this out before, the political system's been weaponized. You know, we're expected, Kirsten and I, and the Democrat caucus, expected to be against James and Bill. If they're running for re-election, we're expected, whoever the Democrat finds to run against them, we're expected to write checks. It could be Donald Duck running against them. We're expected, if they got a D by their name, we've got to get rid of my friend. I'm saying, are you crazy?
I left the Democratic Party, just a reminder.
Sorry?
I left the party. Just want to remind everyone. Yes. Yes. Not a Democrat.
But the bottom line is, we have to, when you get to Washington, you have to pick a side. You know, you caucus here, you caucus there. They have committee assignments.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
They certainly can get too heavy for the market. I mean, we already know that the yield grade 4 percentage is running pretty high. We're feeding these cattle longer. They get a lot more fat on them.
Oklahoma State livestock economist, Dr. Darrell Peel.
So that's one issue, is just how far do you want to push that? Right now, the premiums on choice and prime that you get when you feed cattle longer generally offsets that. So there's not much incentive to hold back on that. The other part of it is just physically the cattle can get too big. You know, again, most packers, have an upper weight limit of around 1050 for carcasses. And, you know, again, they both feedlots and packers have an incentive to push right up against that limit. And in some cases, we may go over. We saw that a decade ago when the last time we were in a similar market situation where we had some cattle that were way overfed and were literally too big to be slaughtered in the normal steer and heifer slaughter plants. They had to be processed in cow and bull plants to get facilities that were big enough and stout enough to handle those large animals. So hopefully we won't see too much of that, but it's a distinct possibility as we go forward.
So that's concerns for larger cattle, but what about boxed beef?
You know, boxed beef, we've been watching it. It dropped this last week pretty sharply at the end of the week. We've been kind of hanging in there in that, you know, mostly $2.95 to $3 range for choice box beef. It dropped down to about $2.92 by the end of last week. And we've been seeing a little bit of weakness in some of the middle meats. So our most expensive cuts, the tenderloin, the ribeye, we've been seeing a little bit of weakness there. That's a little bit concerning. I wouldn't say we for sure have a demand issue at this point, but I think we do have to keep a close eye on it going forward. The end meats have stayed pretty strong, and you know, so it's a little bit concerning going forward. I say all that, and yet we have seen in general some of the grilling meats that normally are coming in, getting ready for Memorial Day. They've been holding up pretty well, so it's kind of a mixed bag. It's not a real clear picture right now what's going on with beef demand. We may be seeing a little bit of weakness, or maybe we're seeing what we often talk about, trading down. When beef gets very expensive, consumers may buy less of the most expensive cuts and trade down to a little bit cheaper cuts, more value-based cuts, and that may be what we're seeing. Again, I think it's too early to really call it for sure, but we'll keep an eye on it going forward.
With all the severe weather we've seen throughout the cattle feeding region, could that impact markets?
We've had a lot of severe weather lately. In fact, the last couple of days of April, I think nationwide, we had like the second largest number of tornadoes reported for the country. Certainly in the Southern Plains and Oklahoma, we had a pretty severe outbreak. And it can impact cattle market. It doesn't really impact the overall markets. It certainly impacts cattle producers. And so I think the impacts tend to be more individual in nature. Obviously, tornadoes are very specific. They can hit a spot and just a few feet away not do any damage. But when those do impact either pastures, sometimes they can affect cattle directly, obviously, in terms of injuries or you know, fatalities in those cattle. The other thing that happens in tornadoes that is a sometimes serious issue is the debris from tornadoes gets scattered across pastures. And sometimes that debris includes things that are not good for cattle to ingest. And that could be everything from petroleum products to nails and wire and things like that. And so, so there's certainly a number of issues individually. Now, will all of that together have an overall impact in the market? Probably not. It's a very specific targeted kind of an impact. So more of an individual thing, but probably not going to impact the overall markets.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I obviously think more parties would be great. My concern is less about what a third party would do and more about what I personally see is the erosion of the two parties that exist.
There's frustration among ag and rural voters. Do we need a third party? Arizona Independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema.
There was a time in our country's history where the two parties had some differing values, some differing ideas of how to get to a solution, but shared some core American values and didn't see each other as an existential threat to the future of the country. I think one of the challenges we see today is that both of the political parties are money machines. These are, you know, multi-billion dollar industries that exist to accrue and hold power. And as you said, Alan, are more interested in denying the other party a victory than they are in advancing an agenda of their own. And I think the danger you see here is this. When each political party views the other party and its members and representatives as an existential danger to the country, and their goal is to eliminate or extinguish the other party, we are no longer talking about a democracy. We are now talking about one-party rule. Our forefathers were concerned about having multiple parties just be in charge of anything. But I think what they would be most concerned about is the idea of one party being in charge of everything. That's the opposite of what our forefathers risked their own lives for when they founded our country. So yes, I think, you know, creating additional parties is a good and reasonable idea, especially to pull folks who have no home, like myself, to a place where they can feel supported in actually moving forward on a moderate, you know, pro-American agenda. But more important than that is shifting the perspective of those who manage, run, and support each political party away from the perspective that the other party is a threat to the country. That is the part of the psyche that is dangerous, because that is where you stop thinking about democracy with a small d and start thinking about power with a big P. And when power with a big P becomes more important than democracy with a small d, then you've lost sight of the goal, which is to protect our country and the Constitution and the freedoms enshrined therein for all of us as Americans. And so when the ends justify the means, when you say it's okay to get rid of the filibuster for the Supreme Court because the Dems did it first, or it's okay to get rid of the filibuster for legislation because we want to pass voting rights, or it's okay to add more people to the Supreme Court so we can protect abortion, all of those little things, all of those are the ends justify the means, which basically are elected officials saying it's more important that I get what I want than that I protect the institution of democracy in our country. And again, back to culture, that's what I think the real danger is. I think, look, a third party might help with that, but I don't think it solves it.
Right.
It's still a cultural problem that we have to address as Americans.
Dr. Bill Cassidy is a Republican senator from Louisiana.
History tells us that if there's a threat of a third party, the incumbent parties act so as to co-opt the message.
There you go.
So it may be that the threat is what corrects as opposed to the actual need.
And this is Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
My belief is every challenge that you've heard us talk about, the frustrations that we've had, every one of those have a tremendous opportunity to be the greatest successes we've ever seen in changing society for the good.
West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin.
Everything we've talked about, whether it be AI or misinformation, can be turned around. Guardrails can be done, put on to protect the public, but give you the greatest information. The ability to when you think, this new generation coming up has the ability to cure famine, diseases around the world, energy starvation, everything you've seen that we're basically, the world is in out of balance, can be brought in balance with these opportunities, and we're the only country that can fix the problems that we have. There's not another country that wants to take our place that has the ability to have the compassion, the economic might, the military might, and basically the cause of freedom and defend our freedom around the world. So God bless America. I really believe that we have the chance to fix it.